Putnam treating you well?
They treat me very well. They've always treated me well, I might add.
You've done all of your books with Putnam, haven't you?
Not all. No, I published with three different houses, but Putnam's is my main publisher and the house that I've been publishing with the longest. 20 years, as a matter of fact.
20 years with Putnam?
Yeah. Oh. I've only been doing books for 20 years, so...
Yeah, well, I was looking over Mother Goose, and, gee, these illustrations are really nice.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about, first, let me ask you a little bit about you, because this
sure.
is certainly far and away not your first book, so you've been doing this for a long time.
Yes.
You were originally from Connecticut, weren't you?
Right, I was born in Connecticut, went to school there, a little town, well, not that little, but a small town called Meriden, halfway in between Hartford and New Haven. I left there in 1952 to go to Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, New York, where I studied illustration and book illustration specifically in my senior year. Graduated from Pratt in 56 and head for the country right then and there. I went and lived in Vermont until 61, then went and lived in Boston for a while, began teaching. And all the time I was trying to get into books, you know, I was bringing my portfolio around. And it was very nice. The editors would either say, oh, we like your work, where do you live? And I'd say, Vermont, and they'd say, oh, well, if you ever move back to New York, let me know. Or they'd say, your work is terrible, get out of here. So actually, I did end up back in New York in about 1963, 64. And at that time, I met the woman who was still my agent. And I got my first book shortly after that, and the rest is history. 100-some-odd books later, I'm still peddling. But now I can live in New Hampshire. I don't have to live in New York.
don't discriminate you.
No. In fact, the editors rather like it, because the editor and the art director from Putnam's, both Nanette and Margaret, you know, they come up and work with me up there in the country. So they really have it tough, right?
Well, it looks as though you... started out very early knowing exactly what you wanted to do.
Oh, yeah, when I was just a little child. Actually, before I even got to school, I told everybody that when I grew up, I was going to be an artist and write stories and draw pictures for books.
Gosh.
And sing and tap dance on the stage. That was sort of a second career in case the first one didn't pan out. And actually, I got to do the sketches for my very first book while I was working in a nightclub in Provincetown. By day, I was working on my first dummy, which is the sketch part of the a picture book, and at night, I was performing in a nightclub.
You actually were singing and tap dancing?
Oh, yeah.
You really did?
Oh, yeah. I used to be quite good. My mother's cousin was Morton Downey, who just recently died. So we had a little bit of I'm half Irish and half Italian, so we've got a little bit of the show business blood in our family as well.
No wonder you tap dance and,
right.
and all that. No, you have to do that. Well, tell me about the first book. Now, what year did that come out?
It was 20 years ago, so it was 1965.
What was the name of that book?
Sound. Mm-hmm. And I only illustrated. I started out as an illustrator.
Mm-hmm.
And that was published by Coward McCann, which is a division of Putnam Sons. And shortly after that one came out, I did my second book, which was a flat fee book for which I got paid like $500, which was terrific in those days. But meanwhile, I was teaching. I had started teaching to pay the rent. And I was teaching in a wonderful place right outside of Boston. So I could teach in Boston and live in New York because my classes were all lumped together for 2 days. And so I was commuting on the good old Hartford-New Haven Railroad. And, I began to get more and more books. And then an editor at Bob's Merrill, who is no longer in the book business, suggested to my rep, I met the woman who was my rep right before that time, and that I might try writing a book. And I was horrified by that idea. I thought, no. I told her, no, I don't have any ideas. And of course, I had about 300, right? And so she invited me to lunch. Now, that did it. See, I was invited to lunch at the Plaza Hotel. And I... the bug really hit me then, because actually in those days, authors were treated with a little bit more finesse than artists. All of my appointments when I was just illustrating books were either right before lunch or right after lunch. So, but I don't have that problem any longer.
No.
I get lunched a lot.
But tell me about that first book that you actually wrote.
That was called The Wonderful Dragon of Timlin, and it was terrible. It was really terrible.
Why?
Well, because I had these adult ideas about what a children's book is, and I hadn't really listened and gone down inside myself to see really what it would be, what it was like when I was a child. What would I have liked when I was a child? I was taking it from sort of a grown-up attitude, and I think that's a real danger for when you're in a field like mine, where you are an adult, but making a product for children.
Well, what do you mean exactly? You had an adult's idea of what the child would like.
Right, exactly.
What's the difference between that and what a child actually does like?
Usually a great deal of difference. And, you know, because I was an artist, it was about a dragon and a princess, and it was filled with, I mean, I called the prince Prince Stefan because I wanted to put an S on his, little jerkin, which was sort of, you know, Superman, all filled with all kinds of little jokes that really I don't think children really care about, you know. They really want a good story. But in 1971, I think it was, 71, 72, the years escaped me, I wrote a book called Nana Upstairs, Nana Downstairs, which was about a real experience of mine. In fact, it's autobiographical. And that changed everything for me. I took the risk, you know, to only write about things that I know about and or to draw things that I care about. And that really made the difference.
Now, you don't have any children of your own.
Nope, I'm not married. I live singly.
Now, isn't that unusual that you specialized in children's books and have no children?
No, I don't think so. A lot of people ask me that, mm-hmm. Especially children. I have some local children that think it would be great to live at my house, you know, because I have a lot of things, you know, that great barn. I work in a big old barn, which is heated and insulated. But I think that it's not so much, you know, my contact with children as my memory of my own childhood that makes the real difference. And actually, there are some people in my field who don't even like children who are very successful. Their books are very successful because they're really writing for the child in themselves. And I think any great artist really, you know, ultimately you have to please yourself or some part of yourself as your inner critic. And I'm just very fortunate that I do have reopened up that direct pipeline to that memory of that little child that I was, who was very, very opinionated, knew exactly what he wanted, and really went out and got it. And if he didn't get it, he would, you know, let everybody know about it. And I do use that kind of instinct and memory as kind of my, like my thermometer.
Hmm. Children's books have changed in recent years, haven't they? It seems to me,
a lot.
That there, when I'm about your age, and it seemed to me that the books I read as a kid were fluff and a Dick and Jane approach. And it seems to me, since I've been doing, for the last number of years, I've been doing this daily broadcast on books, and I try to do children's books wherever I can, there seems to be a more direct approach to letting children know about some of the major problems that we have in not only adult lives, but in the lives of children.
Right.
We are straighter with them, and the stories seem to be more serious and sober.
Yeah, I think that's very true, especially now when you mention Dick and Jane, of course, those are school books. Those are textbooks. And
exactly what I had.
Yeah.
And with clean neighborhoods with a happy mailman.
Yes.
Never had blisters on his feet or anything, but he delivered the mail and always spoke nicely to the children, and the firemen never had suffered smoke inhalation.
No,
they were always friendly.
Right. Always
and
clean. Always clean, yeah.
Wonderful, yeah. There were no blacks in the neighborhood.
No.
Nobody swore.
Garbage.
No garbage.
No garbage cans. You ever notice that? There was never a garbage can.
I don't remember that, but I don't remember seeing any garbage either.
And
mom and dad were always nice, and they never spoke sharply to anyone.
No. Or each other.
Yeah.
And mom cooked.
What
and
an
dad
idyllic life.
Along.
I'd like to go back to that.
Yeah. Well, you know what?
When it was 1943. That was a good year.
Well, I'm a little older because I met Dick and Jane in 1941. And when I met them, I realized, hey, life isn't like this. This isn't the kind of book I want. Now, I loved folktales and legends when I was growing up. And my mother read aloud to us. And I think that had a lot to do with why I really had a strong interest in books. But I agree with you. When I was growing up myself, the books that were available certainly weren't like the books that are available now. And we're really in a very exciting period in children's book publishing, especially. I don't know about the world of adult publishing. I wonder if sometimes novels and bestsellers aren't, you know, created rather than happen. But I think with children's books, right now, the parents that have young children and young children that are going through schools, even their textbooks are changing drastically because the trade book is getting so interesting. But children have a real range of material available for them, everything from fantasy and, you know, and the fluff. Now, see, I didn't consider Dick and Jane fluff. I considered Little Lulu comics. That was my fluff reading. But that made me laugh, and that was kind of like, you know, the popsicle on a hot summer afternoon. But for my meat and potatoes, I read the legends and folktales. I always loved folktales. That's why I do a lot of retelling of folktales, because I think there's a real strong affinity with those age-old stories to young children growing up. Not by young, I mean, you know, under the age of 7.
Of course, all of us read nursery rhymes when we grew up.
Yeah, right.
And now you have a brand new book of the Mother Goose nursery rhymes.
Yes.
Why did you feel that it was important to bring out still another book of Mother Goose?
Well, it's interesting the way this project started. My editor, Margaret Frith, came to me. She had been in Bologna at the book fair and had talked with my editor in England, Joy Backhouse, and they had agreed that, yes, indeed, it was time for me to do a Mother Goose. And that's like saying to an actor, all right, Sir Lawrence, it's time for you to play King Lear. You know, it's part of the repertoire. And it was kind of scary because there are so many editions of A Mother Goose, so I had to find my own way to illustrate it or to present it because I really think of it more of a presentation. And that was really a little scary. I spent a total year on the project, from start to finish, and that's quite unusual for me to spend that much time on a project. But it took me about 4 months to make the rhyme selection alone. But once I said, all right, this is in the stars, I have to do this book, I then realized that what I wanted to do was to do what there are two experts in the world of Mother Goose, believe it or not, Peter and Iona Opie, published great, great annotated tomes on where Mother Goose rhymes have started, where the nursery tales, you know, how they've changed over the centuries. And I went to them as the source. And in reading some of their material, Iona Opie said that no edition of Mother Goose for Children, because their editions are not for children, no edition of Mother Goose for Children should be without illustrations. And every poem should be illustrated. And in the longer poems, every stanza should be illustrated. So that became my sort of goal. I then agreed with Putnam that, you know, it had to be full color and that it was going to be a large collection rather than just taking, a selection of rhymes to fit into a 32-page picture book. So as a result, I've ended up with 128 pages, 200 rhymes, and over 300 illustrations. So it was a very, very long task. But I wanted to echo the past, but I also wanted, you know, my own style to sort of be the sort of vehicle to reintroduce these nursery rhymes to all the children that are around right now. Because, you know, nursery rhymes, there was a time when parents, you know, didn't read Mother Goose to their children or the nursery rhymes. Because there was no such person as Mother Goose. You know, there wasn't a lady in Victorian England who sat down, whose name was, you know, Helen Goose, and and she didn't write all these rhymes. These are all collected over the centuries.
Isn't it true that many of these rhymes were topical in nature at the time that they were
created?
Yeah,
many of them were. And some, the ones that weren't, were they were combinations of sound to help children to speak, believe it or not.
Are they all English?
Yes. They come from an English background.
Yeah. Is there such a thing as an American nursery rhyme?
I think there's a few rhymes in mine that have that I didn't find in the Opie's version of the tales, and there's even one that's original that I couldn't find anywhere that we had growing up in my family. It was a kind of an eating rhyme when my sisters were little, and I guess when I was little, it was knock on the door, peek in, lift up the latch, and walk in, and you knock on the forehead and open the eyes and lift up the nose and your mouth opens and in goes the food. And I couldn't find that, you know, those exact words. So we've included that in this. So there's one original rhyme as well.
Well,
I'm Father Goose, right?
up, and, up until Tommy DePaola's edition of Mother Goose, was there any definitive version?
I guess there's been definitive, you know, editions according to the publishers of those definitive editions.
I've seen scores of them, yeah, but I haven't been able to distinguish. I guess since it's all public domain, anybody can come up with.
Yes, in fact, and it's also, I must admit, it's a vehicle for many artists, you know, children's book artists. And in fact, many of the really fine children's book artists have used Mother Goose as a stepping stone or as a vehicle for their art. I wanted to do a little bit more than that. I wanted to also make it a book that young parents can really use to introduce their children to literature. I think of this book in terms of it being a lap book. 2-year-olds, 1-year-olds sitting in the lap, opening the pages. And I told a friend of mine in New Hampshire to try this with her 9-month-year-old, you know, to open up the book and just go through the pages slowly. And I said, sure as shooting, your daughter's going to reach out for one of those illustrations. And sure enough, it happened on the second page. So, and I said, then read that rhyme to them. Because, you know, we have to start paying attention to verbal skills as well as illiteracy, et cetera, because we're having a big breakdown in the language of this country. I think a lot of people are aware of it.
What is the age bracket the book is geared to?
I guess for all ages.
All ages?
Sure. You know, if you happen to like it, in fact, I love it when I'm autographing, you know, elderly men and women. In fact, there was a woman yesterday when I was autographing. She had 2 copies, and she said, this is for my children, but this one's for my husband. And her husband was standing over there, and he said, I never had a Mother Goose of my own. It was a man my own age in his 50s. And he was delighted that it was going to be for him. You know, and I wrote for Dave. Best wishes.
In fact, you might have read Jonathan Cott's book called Pipers at the Gates of Dawn.
Oh, yes, yes.
I think it was a Random House book came out a couple of years ago. And that is a book that took the philosophical approach that there is a great deal of wisdom in children's literature that can be used by adults.
Mm-hmm.
And should be used by adults.
Right, right. You know, I think that a lot of people don't realize that to write for children is very difficult, especially if you're taking it seriously. I think there's a lot of ice cream and junk food out there in the world of children's books, and I'm not saying that should be taken off the shelves, but I do think that if we're going to have a nation of readers, which is kind of a goal for many people, that we've got to start children out very, very young, and that wisdom is there and it stays with you, and then you can go back and reread it and rediscover it and never forget it. Now, with the Mother Goose rhymes, I learned so much in doing my research. I spent 4.5 months just reading, you know, Jack and Jill Went Up the Hill. But the interesting thing about it was that I began to be so aware of those sounds and the rhythm of those sounds, and how the combinations of sounds really is enriching my ears and my vocabulary and the way I speak. And then to be able to draw pictures for it as well was just really a wonderful project, because I really care about children a lot, even though I don't have any. And it was so nice to be able to have the opportunity to do a really classy book. I mean, it's for very young children. And Putnam's is just, you know, they've been wonderful in letting this be as classy a project as possible and still available.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope it will be. And the way I've been signing them the last couple of weeks is it seems to be catching people's eye, which I'm delighted
That's
for.
Terrific. You know, it just occurred to me that there is an annotated Mother Goose that I think I have at home, and it's been many years since I've looked at it, but that explains.
That's right, and that's by Peter and Iona Opie.
Oh, is that?
Yep. They're the ones that did that from Oxford University Press.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very dry historical tone.
Yes, it's not for kids.
No, no. In fact, if you want to turn your children off to Mother Goose, just start reading that.
No, but it indicates what the political
exactly.
ramifications.
In fact, like, you know, Mary, Quite Contrary was a street song, an Elizabethan street song about Mary, Queen of Scots. And the cockleshells, just to give you, to show you that I've read this book, the cockleshells was the symbol of St. James and the court of St. James, of course, the Spanish court. And that was their kind of symbol. And they were the Catholics, and that's why. And I forget what the silver bells indicated, but pretty maids all in the row were her ladies in waiting that lined the corridor as she was led off to get her, you know, head chopped off. So.
Well, you had a big day, in, according to some of this publicity material here that Putnam sent over. You had a Meriden day, DePaola day in Meriden.
Four days.
What was that like?
I'll tell you. It was something that I never really thought, you know, I never in my wildest dreams thought, you know, my old hometown would have a celebration for me, that I would be invited back as, you know, a son who made good. And it was just fantastic. It's, you expect this for baseball players or astronauts, but, you know, an artist, you know, hey. And it was just wonderful. It was pulled together by the library there. I had one day of speaking at the library. They had a parade for me with 500 children dressed as characters from my books. I was very worried that there were so many children in the parade there'd be no one to watch it, but the librarian assured me that for every child there were two parents who'd be along. But there were more than that. I got to sit on the back of a car and wave, you know, like a celebrity, and they had banners across the street that said, you know, "Welcome home, Tommy DePaola." And then on Sunday of the final day of the weekend, I was inducted into the Meriden Hall of Fame, which is really a very big honor, because there were some well-known people from Meriden. Rosa Poncel was from Meriden, and the founder of International Silver Company was from Meriden. So
what's his name?
I don't remember. Thanks for asking me, right? There was a Rogers. I do remember there was William Rogers. But I don't remember the name of the man who started International Silver Company. But their plaques are all up in what was the old library. It's now called the Community Cultural Center in Meriden. And it was very nice to see. I saw people that I hadn't seen in a long, long time. And that was kind of a game with me. You know, I'd see people, they'd come up and say, "I bet you don't know who I am." And I maybe had seen them in line, you know, five people down. Oh, who is that? Who is that? But, you know, one of the wonderful things was that I was able to tell personally my fifth grade teacher, Rose Mulligan, how important she had been to my life. And that was a real thrill, because she really was. She was one of the important teachers in my schooling. And, you know, to be able to see someone who's in... She looked exactly the same, except her hair was white instead of black, right? And she was just... It was just wonderful to see her and to say to her, "Miss Mulligan." She said, "Tommy, you can call me Rose."
Isn't it interesting that a teacher like that, or any teacher, has such an enormous influence on a kid? And mm-hmm. you know this years and years later, but, I mean, the teachers who were mean to you and nasty to you and insulting, and the teachers who, like Miss Mulligan, mm-hmm. inspired you.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? That yeah. Teachers, I don't think teachers often know what power that
no,
they
have. No, I don't think
have.
So. No, in fact, she was, you know, she said to me, "Stop telling me this, you're embarrassing me." And I said, "Well, but you've got to know." You know, one of the things she did, she taught fifth and a double fifth, sixth grade. And we fifth graders knew that we were the smart fifth graders, and the sixth graders knew that they were the dumb sixth graders. That's the way it worked in our school somehow or other. And but she read aloud to us every single day of the school year. At the end of the afternoon, you know, right, you know, 15, 20 minutes before the end of the school day, we'd all sit down, put our work away, and she would read aloud to us. And she had been doing this for years. And she also realized that I wanted to, you know, that I was going to be an artist. When I said it, I meant it. And she allowed me, she probably shouldn't have, but she allowed me not to finish my arithmetic, which I hated with a passion. And she was always finding projects for me to do to keep me interested. And I was very lucky. She was one of maybe three teachers in my grammar school years, you know, those 6 years. It was really so important. And I just felt so lucky to be able to tell her how much she meant to me. And there was a souvenir program, which was rather nice. I had to write a little autobiographical sketch. And that was an experience, because the more I wrote, the more I remembered. And I finally had to have somebody take it away from me, because I'd still be home writing it now. But they sold ads, and her niece bought her a space for an ad, and all she said was, "I knew you could do it."
Nice. Well, your specialty, of course, has been children's books, children's right. illustrations, and I guess I read that you did a Neiman Marcus catalog mm-hmm. at one point. But are you going to be branching out and doing more adult things?
Well, I started out, of course, having to branch out and do other things because I was waiting for that to get that first book. You know, I didn't come right out of art school and get my first book. It really did take a little bit of a struggle. As I said before, you know, I didn't live in New York, and that seemed to be a stumbling block. And after I got working on my first book, I realized what they were talking about because, you know, so much can go wrong. Because, you know, you're learning a new discipline, entering a new industry in real terms. But so I've always done my paintings and my drawings. I've had, up to this point, I think I've had about 14 one-man shows and been in so many group shows with other things other than books. And the Neiman Marcus people came to me because they had seen some of my book illustrations and asked me if I'd be interested in doing the cover for their catalog. And it's like a snowball, you know. I said, sure, why not? And other people saw that work, and I'm about to be viewed by millions of readers because I've done a design for the American Booksellers Association. They're going to have a Christmas insert in Time magazine, and that happens the third week in November. So I am going to be my illustration will be there for Time magazine, and that's kind of a exciting thing to think that many millions of people will see something that I've done.
Well, Tommy DiPaolo, thank you very much for coming and talking to me, and I can tell by chatting with you for the last half hour or so that you're really a kid at heart.
Yeah, I really am. Yeah. Thanks for inviting me. I really enjoyed chatting with you.